Side 4, The Boat of a Million Years by Paul Anderson, continuing on page 95. Had he tried that, it would have been the end of him. But he stopped, shivered, turned away.
No, he mumbled. This is all too spooky. I'm off to my own doom, Norna guessed.
He lumbered up the trail, into the woods, and beyond sight. Then Guest could sit down and bring a whole heed to the steering of his body. He had stopped the bleeding before he suffered over much loss, though he would be weak for a few days. No matter. He could stay here until he was fit to travel. The earth would provide for him. He began to hasten the knitting of the flesh. He dared not wish he were able to heal the wound inside. 2.
However, we only met fleetingly, Starkad and I, Guest went on. Afterward, hearsay about him reached me now and then, until I went abroad again, and when I came back, he was long dead, slain as he had wanted.
Why have you fared so widely? Asked King Olaf. What have you sought?
What I never found, Guest answered. Peace.
No, that was not wholly right, he thought. Over and over had he been at peace, in the nearness of beauty or wisdom, the arms of a woman, the laughter of children. But how short the whiles! His latest time as a husbandman in the uplands of Norway seemed already the dream of a single night. Ingrid's youthful gladness, its rebirths in the cradle he had carved, her heart that stayed high while she grew more gray than he, but then the shriveling years, and afterward the burials, the burials. Where now wandered Ingrid? He could not follow. Not her, nor any of those who glimmered on the rim of memory. Not that first and sweetest of all, garlanded with ivy, and in her hand a blade of flint.
In God is peace, said the priest.
It could be, it could be. Today church bells rang in Norway, as they had done for a lifetime or more in Denmark, yes, above that halidom of the mother, where he and the garland girl had offered flowers. He had seen the charioteers and their storm gods come into the land. He had seen bronze and iron, the wagon trains bound south for Rome and the Viking ships bound west for England, sickness and famine, drought and war, and life patiently beginning anew. Each year went down into death, and awaited the homecoming of the sun that would bring it to rebirth. He, too, could let go if he would, and drift away on the wind with the leaves. King Olaf's priest thought that soon every quest would end, and the dead arise. How good if that was true! Evermore folk believed so. Why should not he? Come unto me, all ye that labor and are heavy laden, and I will give you rest. Days later, Guest said, Yes, I will take your baptism. The priest wept for joy. Olaf whooped. But when it was done, that evening in the hall, Guest took forth a candle and lighted it at a torch. He lay down on a bench where he could see it. Now I may die, he told them. Now I have yielded. He let the candle flame fill his vision, his being. He made himself one with it. The light waxed for him until he almost thought it shone on those lost faces, brought them back out of the dark, nearer and nearer. His heartbeat heeded him, slowing toward quietness. Olaf and the young warrior stood dumb with awe. The priest knelt in shadow and prayed, without uttering the words aloud. The candle flame flickered to naught. Norna Guest lay still. Through the hall sounded a wind of the oncoming winter. Chapter 6. Encounter. From afar the gold shone like a daylight even star. Sometimes trees hid it, a woodlot or a remnant of forest, but always as the travelers moved west they saw it again, brilliant in a vastness of sky where a few clouds wandered, above a plain where villages and freshly greening croplands lay tiny beneath the wind. Hours wore on. Sunbeams now tangled themselves in Svoboda Volodarovna's brows, and the hills ahead loomed clear, the city upon the highest of them. Behind its walls and watchtowers lifted domes, spires, the smoke from a thousand hearts, and over all soared the brightness. Presently she heard chimes, not the single voice of a countryside chapel, but several, which must be great ones to sound across this distance, ringing together in music such as surely sang among the angels or in the abode of Yarilo. Leipiliev pointed. "The bell tower, the gilt cupola, belongs to the cathedral of Sviataya Sofia," he said. "That's not any saint's name, but means holy wisdom. It comes from the Greeks, who brought the word of Christ to the Rusi." A short, somewhat tubby man, with a pug nose and a scraggly beard turning gray, he was given to self-importance. Yet leathery skin bespoke many years of faring, often through danger, and goodly garb told of success won by it. "Then all this is new?" asked Svoboda, in amazement. "Well, that church and certain other things," Gleip replied. "Grand Prince Yaroslav Vladimirovich has built them since these lands fell to him, and he moved his seat here from Novgorod. But, of course, Kiev was already great. It was founded in Rurik's time, 2 centuries ago, I believe." And to me this was only a dream, Svoboda thought. It would have been less real than the old gods that we suppose still haunt the wilderness, did not merchants like Glaib pass through our little settlement once in a while, bringing their goods that few of us can afford, but also their tales that everyone is eager to hear. She clucked to her horse and nudged it with her heels. These lowlands near the river were still wet after the spring floods, and the mire of the road had wearied the horse. Behind her and her guide trailed his company, half a dozen hirelings and 2 apprentices leading the pack animals or driving a pair of laden wagons. Here, safe from bandits or Petineg raiders, they had laid weapons aside and wore merely tunics, trousers, tall hats. Glaib had put on good clothes this morning to make a proper show when he arrived. A fur-trimmed cloak was draped over a brocaded coat. Svoboda was well-clad, too, in a gown of gray wool bordered with embroideries. Hiked up across the saddle, her skirts revealed finely stitched boots. A headcloth covered flaxen braids. Weather had only tinged her with bronze. Work had built strength without stooping the back or coarsening the hands. Well-figured enough that the big bones did not stand forth, she looked at the world out of blue eyes set widely in a face of blunt nose, full mouth, square chin. Lineage and fortune showed. Her father had been head man of the village in his day, and each of her husbands had been better off than most men, blacksmith, hunter-trapper, horse-breeder and dealer. Nonetheless, she must keep herself reined in if she would appear calm, and the heart in her breast kept breaking free of that grip. When she came in clear sight of the Dnieper, she could not help catching her breath. Brown and mighty rolled the river. Easily 500 paces across, she guessed. To her right, a low, grassy island divided it. Lesser streams flowed in from either side. The far shore was surprisingly much forested, though houses and other buildings led up from the water to the city and clustered around its ramparts, while orchards or small farmsteads and pastures nestled elsewhere in the hills. On this bank was just a muddy huddle of dwellings. Its laborers and peasants gave the travelers scant heed. They were used to such. What did draw some stares and mutters was her. Few women accompanied any traders, and those who did were seldom of an honorable kind. A ferry waited. Its owner hastened to meet Glaib and chaff her with him, then went about calling for crew to man the sweeps. 3 trips would be necessary. The gangway was steeply pitched, for the wharf was built high against the yearly rise. Glaib and Svoboda were among the first to cross. They took stance near the bows, the better to watch. Voices barked, wood creaked, water lapped and splashed. The vessel started off. The breeze was cool, wet, full of silty smells. Fowl winged about, ducks, geese, lesser birds, once a flight of swans overhead, but not so many as at home. Here they were hunted more. "We came at a busy time," Glaib warned. "The city is crammed with strangers. Brawls are common, and worse than that can befall, despite everything the Grand Prince does to keep order. I shall have to leave you alone while I attend to my work. Be very careful, Svoboda Volodarovna." She nodded impatiently, barely hearing words he had spoken over and over, her gaze and her heed aimed forward. As they approached the west bank, the ships gathered there seemed to breed until they were past counting. She caught hold of her senses and told herself that now the outer hulls, riding at anchor, did not hide those at the docks from her, and the number must be scores rather than hundreds. It took away none of the wonder. Here were no barges such as she was on, nor rowboats and dug-out punts such as her own folk used. These were long and lean, clinker-built, gaudily painted, many with stem-posts carved into fantastic figureheads. Oars, yards, and unstepped masts lay on trestles above the benches. How their sails must spread like wings when they came to the sea! "Yes, the famous merchant fleet," said Glape. "Most likely all are now gathered. Tomorrow, perhaps, they leave for Constantinople, New Rome." Again Svoboda scarcely listened. She was trying to imagine that sea the ships would find at the river's end. It reached farther than a man could look. It was rough and dark and salt of taste. Huge snakes and people who were half-fish beset its waves, so the tales went. She strove to form the vision, but failed. As for the city of the Basileus, how could the claim be true that it made Kiev, looked small and poor? To go and find out, to be there. She sighed once, then shoved longing aside. Quite enough newness lay straight ahead. What she might gain and what she might suffer were alike unforeseeable. Even in fireside stories, no woman had ever ventured this that she was venturing, but none had ever been driven by a need like hers. Memories flitted through her, secret thoughts that had come when she was alone, working in house or garden, gathering berries or firewood in the outskirts of the forest, lying wakeful in the night. Could she also be special, a princess stolen from the crib, a girl chosen for destiny by the old gods or the Christian saints? No doubt every child nursed daydreams of that sort. They faded away as one grew up, but in her they had slowly rekindled. No prince came riding, no fox or firebird uttered human words. Life simply went on, year by year by year, until at last she broke free. And that was her own altogether ordinary doing. And here she was. Her heart quickened afresh. It hammered fear out of her. Wonders, in truth. The ferry knocked against bollards. Its crew made fast. The passengers debarked into racket and bustle. Glape pushed through the crowd of workers, hawkers, sailors, soldiers, idlers. Svoboda stayed close at his side. She had always taken care to uphold self-command in his presence, bargain rather than appeal, be friendly rather than forlorn. But today he knew what he did while she was bewildered. This was nothing like a fair at the town she knew, which was little more than a fort for villagers to take refuge in. She could watch, though, hearken, learn. He talked to a man of the harbor masters and a man of the princes. He left orders with a man of his about where to bring the rest of his band, and finally he led her up the hill into the city. Its walls were massive, earthen, whitewashed. An arched gateway, flanked by turrets and crowned with a tower, stood open. Guards in helmet and chain mail leaned on their pikes, no hindrance to the traffic that thrust to and fro, on foot, on horseback, donkey cart, ox-drawn wagon, sometimes sheep or cattle herded toward slaughter. Once a monstrous beast, like a thing out of nightmare, that Glape called a camel. Beyond, streets twisted steep. Most of the vividly painted buildings that lined them were timber. Below, roofs of mossy shingle or blossoming turf. Often they stood two, even three stories high. In the windows of those that were brick, there gleamed glass. Above them she glimpsed the golden cupola where the bells dwelt, surmounted by a cross. Noise, smells, surge, and push of bodies overwhelmed Svoboda. Glape must raise his voice when he pointed out some new kind of person. The priest she knew at once, black-gowned and long-bearded. But a man more coarsely clad was a monk, sent into town from his nearby cave on an errand, while a magnificently robed elder born in a litter was a bishop. Townsfolk, housewives who dickered on a market square overflowing with goods and people, portly merchants, common workers, slaves, children, peasants from the hinterland,
wore an endlessness of different garbs, and nowhere the dear decorations of home. Tarry sailors, tall blonde Northmen, Poles and Wends and Livonians and Finns in their various raiments, high-cheeked tribesmen off the steps, a pair of Byzantines clothed with elegance and disdain. She was lost among them, and at the same time she was upraised, carried along, drunk on marvel. At a house near the south wall, Glape halted. "This is where you will stay," he said. She nodded. He had told her about it. A master weaver whose daughters had married earned extra money by taking in trustworthy lodgers. A maid-servant answered Glape's knock. The goodwife appeared. Glape's followers brought in Svoboda's baggage, and he paid the woman. They went to the room that would be hers. Cramped, it held a narrow bed, stool, pot, basin, water jug. Above the bed hung a picture, a man with a halo, letters around him to spell out a name that the wife said was Saint Yuri. "He slew a dragon and saved a maiden," she explained. "A fine guardian for you, my dear. You have come to be married, I believe." The sharp, hasty accent forced Svoboda to listen closely. "So we trust," Glape replied. "Arranging the betrothal will take days, you understand, Olga Borisovna. And then there will be the wedding preparations. Now this lady is tired after a long, hard journey." "Of course, Glape Ilyev. What else? Hungry, too, I'm sure. I will go see that the soup is hot. Come to the kitchen when you are ready, both of you." "I must be straightway off myself," he said. "You know how a trader has to watch and pounce at this season, like a sparrowhawk, if he would strike any bargains worth half his trouble." The woman bustled off. So did his men at a gesture from him. For a moment he and Svoboda were alone. Light was dim. This room had only a small window covered by membrane. Svoboda searched Glape's face as best she could, where he stood in the doorway. "Will you meet Igor Olegyev today?" she asked low. "I doubt that," he sighed. "He is an important man, after all, his voice strong in the folk moot, and very busy while the fleet is here, not just as a chandler, but, well, when you deal with men of many nations, it becomes politics and schemes, and—" He was not wont to speak thus awkwardly. "I leave word, and hope he can receive me tomorrow. Then we'll set a time for you to meet with him, and I'll pray for a good outcome." "You said that was sure." "No, I said I think it likely. He is interested, and I know him and his situation well. But how could I make you any outright promise?" She sighed in her turn. "True. At worst, you said, you can find somebody less well off." He stared down at the rushes on the floor. "That need not happen either. We are friends of old, you and I, right? I could look after you better than you have thus far let me do." "You have been more than kind to me," she said gently. "Your wife is a lucky woman." "I had better go," he mumbled. "Get my whole party together, everyone quartered, wares stored, and then tomorrow, whenever I can, I'll stop here and give you the news. Until then, God be with you, Svoboda Volodarovna." He turned and hurried off. She stood a while, her thoughts a tumble, before she found her way to the kitchen. Olga gave her a bowl of rich beef broth, crowded with leeks and carrots, black bread and ample butter on the side. She settled herself on the bench across the table and chattered away. "Glape Ilyev has told me so much about you." With a wariness that the years had taught her, Svoboda steered the talk. Just how much had the man said? It was a relief to learn he had been as shrewd as usual. He had described a widow with no dependent children alive and no prospect of remarriage in her distant, rude neighborhood. Out of charity and in hope of earning credit in heaven, Glape had suggested her to the chandler Igor Olegyev of Kiev, himself lately left bereaved among several youngsters. The prospect appeared good. A woodlander could learn city ways if she was clever, and this woman had other desirable qualities as well. Therefore Glape helped Svoboda convert her inheritance to cash, a dowry, and took her along on his next trip. "Ah, poor darling, poor little one," Olga dabbed at tears.
No child of yours above the earth, and no man to wed one so young and beautiful? I cannot understand that. Svoboda shrugged. There was ill feeling. Please, spare me talking about it. Yes, village feuds. People can indeed get nasty, hemmed in by themselves all their lives. And then pagan fears prey on them. Do they imagine you're unlucky, cursed by a witch, perhaps, just because you've had many sorrows? May God now at last prosper your life. So Gleip had told truth while holding back truth, a traitor's skill. For an instant, Svoboda wondered about him. They got along well together, she and he. They could do more than that if this marriage scheme fell through. Let the priests call it sin. Kupala the joyous would not, and maybe the old gods did linger on earth. But no, Gleip was already gray. Too little time remained for him that she could bring herself to hurt the wife whom she had never met. She knew how loss felt. Having eaten and Olga gone back to a housewife's work, Svoboda sought her room. She unpacked, stowed her possessions, and wondered what to do next. There had always been some task, if only to spin thread. But she had left the things of home behind, with home itself. Nor could she just sink into blessed idleness, savoring it, or into sleep, as country folk were apt to when the rare, brief chance came. That was not the way of a headman's daughter, wife to a man of weight. Restlessness churned in her. She paced the floor, flung herself onto the bed, bounced up again, yawned, glowered, paced anew. Should she go help Olga's household? No, she wouldn't know her way about. Moreover, Igor Olegyev might well think it demeaned his bride. If anything was to come of that. What was he like? Gleip called him a good fellow, but Gleip would never see him from a woman's side, not even well enough that what he said of Igor's looks called forth anything real for Svoboda. St. Yuri, there on the wall, she could at least take the measure of, gaunt, big-eyed. She knelt before him and tried to ask his blessing. The words stuck in her throat. She had been dutiful but not devout, and today proper meekness was beyond her. She paced. Decision came slowly. Why must she stay penned between these walls? Gleip had told her to be careful, but she had often gone alone into the woods, fearless of wolf or bear, and taken no harm. Once she caught a runaway horse by the bridle and dragged him to a stop. Once she killed a mad dog with an axe. Once she and her neighbors crowded into the stockaded town and stood off a Pechenegg raid. Besides, while the hours dribbled away here, life pulsed out there, newness, wonder. The bell tower shone tall. Of course! The Church of the Holy Wisdom. There, if any place, she could feel prayerful. There God would hear and help. Yes, surely. She threw a cloak on, pinned it fast, drew up the hood, glided forth. Nobody could forbid her to leave, but it would be best if she went unnoticed. She did pass a servant, maybe a slave, but he gave her a dull glance and continued scrubbing out a tile stove in the main room. The door closed behind Svoboda. The street swept her off. For a while she wandered, shyly at first, then in a daze of delight. Nobody offered her any rudeness. Several young men did stare, and a couple of them grinned and nudged each other, but that just made her tingle. Now and then somebody jostled her by chance. It was less often than earlier. The ways were less thronged as the sun sank westward. Finally she got a clear sight of the cathedral and steered by it. When she saw St. Sophia full on, she caught her breath. 60 paces long it was, she guessed dizzily, rising white and pale green in walls and bays, arched doorways and high glass windows, up and up to, yes, 10 domes in all, 6 bearing crosses, and 4 spangled with stars. For a long time she could only stand and look. At last, mustering courage, she went on past workmen who were adding to the splendor. Her heart thudded. Was this forbidden? But besides priests, commoners went in and out. She passed the entrance. After that, for a time during which time was not, She drifted like a Rusalka beneath the water. Almost she wondered if she too had drowned and become such a spirit. Twilight and hush enfolded her. Windows glowed with colors and images, walls with gold and images. But no, that stern, strange face overhead was Christ, Lord of the world, in the ring of his apostles, and yonder giantess made of little stones was his mother, and the song, the deep, moaning tones that finally lifted from behind a carven screen while bells rang high above, those were in praise of his father. She prostrated herself on cold flags. Awareness seeped into her much later. The church had become a cavern of night. She was alone, except for a few clergy and many candles. Where had the day gone? She crossed herself and hastened out. The sun was down, the sky still blue, but swiftly darkening, the streets full of dusk between walls in whose windows flame-light fluttered yellow. They were well-nigh deserted. Her breath, footfalls on cobbles, rustle of skirts sounded loud in the quiet. Turn right at this corner, left at the next. Now wait, that was wrong. She had never seen yonder house with the rafter ends carved into heads. She was lost. She stopped, filled her lungs and eased them again, grinned wryly. Fool, she whispered, at your age you should have known better. She glanced about. Roofs stood black against a heaven gone almost as dark, where three stars trembled. Opposite, paleness crept upward, the moon rising. So, west and east. Her lodging stood near the south wall. If she kept on that way, as closely as these crooked lanes allowed, she should reach it. Then she could knock on a door and ask directions. No doubt Olga would make a fuss, and tomorrow Glape would chide her. She stiffened her back. She was Headman Volodar's daughter. Picking her steps carefully, gown held above ankles, to avoid the worst muck, she set off. Twilight thickened toward night. Air lay chilly. The moon gave wan light when she saw it, but mostly it was still behind roofs. Lamp glow, smoke, smells of kvass and cookery spilled from a half-open door. Voices barked, laughter bayed. She scowled and went by on the far side of the street, an inn where men were getting drunk. She had seen that sort of thing when she visited the town with a husband. Rostislav had grown too fond of it. He'd reel back to her, all stench and sweat. Boots thudded behind her, louder, nearer. She quickened her steps. The other did, too, and drew alongside. Ha! He growled. Greeting to you! She could barely understand him. They entered a patch of moonlight, and he became more than a shadow. A head taller than she, he blocked the gathering western stars out of her sight. She saw a pate shaven, except for a lock on the right side, a bristle of mustache under a nose that had once been broken, tattoos over the shaggy breast and down the thick arms. He wore a shirt half unlaced, broad trews, short cloak, everything stiff with old grease. The knife at his belt was nearly of sword size, a weapon forbidden to everyone but the prince's guards within this city. A demon flashed ice-sharp through her, and then, no, a Varyag. I've heard about them, Northmen and Rusi who ply the rivers, walking storm winds. She pulled her look from him and sought to go on. A hand clamped on her right arm. Now, now, not be hasty, he laughed. You are for fun this late, no? I give you fun. Let me be, she cried, and tugged at the grip. He wrenched. Pain stabbed sickeningly through her shoulder. She stumbled. He held her fast. Come, he said. There's an alley. You'll like it. The smell of him caught at her gorge. She must gag before she could scream. Quiet, you. Nobody come. His free hand cuffed. Her head rocked. Darkness roared through. Nonetheless, somehow she dug her heels down and screamed again. Quiet or I, ha! He cast her to the cobbles. When she could see upward, he had turned to meet two others. They must have been on a side street and heard, she thought, amidst the dizziness. Let them help me. Christ! Dashbog! Yarilo! St. Yuri! Help them help me.
The Varyag's knife was out.
Go, he snarled. No need you. Go.
She realized that he was drunk, and that that made him the more dangerous. The smaller of the two men advanced, cat-footed.
I think best you go cool that noggin of yours, friend, he replied mildly.
His own knife slipped forth. It was a tool for eating and ordinary cutting, a sliver against that great blade, nor did its bearer seem any kind of warrior. His slender frame bore a fur-lined coat and trousers smoothly tucked into soft boots. Svoboda made out that much because his companion carried a lantern which threw a dull glow on them both, and a puddle of it at their feet. The Varyag grinned beneath the moon.
"Dainty lordling and cripple," he jeered. "You tell me what to do. Scoot, or I find how white your tripes be."
The second new man put down the lantern. It had been in his left hand. His right was missing. From a leather cup strapped to that forearm reached an iron hook. Otherwise he was muscular, his garb stout but plain. He drew his small knife.
"We two," he rumbled. "You alone. Cadog say go. You go."
Unlike the slim man, he could barely speak Russian.
"Two cockroaches," the Varyag yelled. "Perun thunder me. Enough."
He made a long step forward. His weapon flashed. The slim man, Cadog, swayed aside. He thrust out an ankle and gave a push. The Varyag tripped, crashed to the stones. The man with the hook laughed. The Varyag roared, sprang up, charged him. The hook slashed. Its curve ended in a point that went deep into the attacker's upper arm. The Varyag yelled. The opponent's knife cut his wrist. His own iron clattered loose. Cadog danced in and, half-playfully, seized his hairlock and sliced it across.
"The next trophy comes from between your legs," Cadog said with a leer.
The Varyag howled, whirled, fled. Echoes died away. Cadog hunkered down by Svoboda. "Are you well, my lady?" he asked. "Here, lean on me." He helped her rise. His companion stooped for the Varyag's knife.
"No, leave that," Cadog ordered.
His Russian must be for her benefit.
"I wouldn't want the guard to find it on us. That oaf's carcass would scarcely be as inconvenient. Let's get away. The racket may well have drawn attention we can do without. Come, my lady."
I'm unhurt. The breath sobbed in Svoboda's throat. She had, in fact, suffered nothing but possible bruises. A measure of days remained. She went blindly along, Cadog's hand on her elbow. The man with the lantern and the hook asked something that must mean, "Where to?"
"Our lodging, of course," Cadog snapped in Russian. "If we should meet a patrol, then nothing has happened. We've simply been out for a little drink and merriment. Will you agree to that, my lady? You do owe us something, and we'd hate to miss the fleet's departure tomorrow because Yaroslav's officers wanted to question us."
"I must get home," she pleaded.
"You shall. We'll see you safely back, never fear. But first..."
Shouts lifted to the rear.
"Hark, somebody did come. They found the knife, and if they have a lantern, too, they'll have seen the blood and scuffled awful. Here."
Cadog led them into an alley, a tunnel of murk. "Round about, but it avoids trouble. We'll lie low for an hour or two, and then escort you, my lady." They emerged on a broad street, moonbright. Svoboda's wits had returned. She wondered how far she could trust the pair. Might it be wisest to insist she go back to Olga's at once? If they refused, she could strike out by herself, no worse off than earlier. But that had not been well off at all. And a throbbing, a warmth. Never had she known anybody like this. Never again would she, perhaps. They were to sail in the morning, and she was once more to become a wife. Then Cadog plucked his companion's sleeve and said merrily, "Whoa, Rufus! Don't go on past." A house bulked before them. The door was unbarred. They wiped their feet and trod through into a space where she could barely see tables, benches, a couple of night lamps burning. "The common room," said Cadog in her ear. "This is a hostel for those who can afford it. Quiet, please." She peered.
Rufus Lantern showed him to be lumpy-featured, freckled, the dense whiskers and thin hair a bright yellowish red. Cadog was altogether foreign, his face narrow and aquiline, the eyes slightly aslant like a fin's, but large and brown, hair shoulder-length, and as raven-black as the beard he kept trimmed to a point. A golden finger-ring was equally alien in its workmanship, a snake that bit its tail. Seldom had she met as ready a smile as was his. "Well, well," he murmured, "I had no idea that the lady in distress was so comely." He bowed as if she were a princess. "Fear not, I repeat. We'll take proper care of you. Alas for your raiment." Glancing down, she saw filth smeared over it.
I could tell people I fell," she stammered. "That is true."
"I think we can do better," Cadog said. Rufus followed them upstairs to a second-floor chamber. It was large, wainscoted, drapes by a glazed window and a rug on the floor, with four beds, a table, several stools, and whatever else comfort required. Rufus took the candle from his lantern and used it to light the tapers in a seven-branched brass holder. His deftness told Svoboda he must have lost his hand long ago to have learned so well how to do without it. "We are the only two," Cadog told Svoboda. "It's worth the cost. Now," he squatted by a chest, took a key from his pouch, opened the lock. "Most of our goods are on our ship, naturally, but here are some especially valuable, whether from abroad or acquired in Kiev. They include—" he rummaged. "Ah, yes." The fabric he drew out shone in the candlelight. "I regret we can't prepare a hot bath at this hour, my lady, but yonder you'll find a basin, water jug, soap, towels, slop jar. Make free, and afterward don this. Meanwhile, of course, Rufus and I will absent ourselves. If you'll open the door a crack and hand out your soiled things, he'll see what he can do toward cleansing them." The redbeard made a mouth. He grumbled in an unknown tongue. Cadog replied and, somehow, jollied him till he nodded. They took single candles and holders and left. Svoboda stood alone with her bewilderment. Did she dream? Had she blundered into elven land, or had she met a pair of gods here in this Christian stronghold? Suddenly she laughed. Whatever befell, it was new. It was a wonder. She unfastened brooches and laces, pulled clothing over her head, held it around the door as Cadog had suggested. Somebody took it. She closed the door again and went to wash. The cloth caressed a nakedness that the cool air seemed to flow across. She dawdled at the task. When a knock sounded, she called, "Not yet," and hurried to dry herself. The garment, tossed onto a bed, drew a gasp from her. It was a robe of sheening, baby-smooth material, gold-trimmed blue, secured by silver buttons. Her feet were now bare. Well, peeping from beneath the skirt, they would catch glances, she thought, and flushed hot. Quickly she combed locks fallen astray around her coiled braids, and knew their amber color would show well above the dress. "Enter," she said, not quite evenly. Cadog appeared, a tray balanced on his left hand. He shut the door behind him and put the tray on the table. It bore a flagon and two cups. "I never knew silk could be this beautiful," he said. "What?" asked Svoboda. She wished her pulse would slow. "No matter. I'm often rather brash. Please sit and enjoy a stoup with me. I woke the potboy to give me of the landlord's choicest. Take your ease. Recover from that foul experience." She lowered herself to a stool. Before he did likewise, Cadog poured out a red liquid with a summery odor. "You are very kind," she whispered. "As Glape is kind," she thought. Then unwillingly, "No, Glape is a countryside trader growing old. He can read and write, but what else does he know? What has he seen and done beyond his narrow rounds?" "How can I repay you?" "Immediately." That was a foolish thing to say. However, Cadog only smiled, raised his cup, and replied, "You can tell me your name, my lady, and whatever else you care to. You can gladden me with your company for a short while. That is ample. Drink, I pray you.
She sipped. Deliciousness flowed over her tongue. This was no berry wine of the backwoods. It was... I am...
Almost she gave him her baptismal name, but of course that would be unwise. She believed she could trust this man, but if a sorcerer somehow learned it, she would be open to spells. Besides, she seldom thought about it. Svoboda Volodarovna, the name she used at home.
From afar.
Where is your friend, Rufus?
Oh, I've put him to getting your clothes as clean as possible.
Afterward, he won't disturb us. I gave him a flagon of his own to keep him company. A loyal man, brave, but limited.
Your servant, then?
Did a shadow flit across his face?
An associate of mine for a long, long time. He lost his hand fighting once, warding my back when a gang of Saxons ambushed us. He kept on fighting left-handed, and we escaped.
What were Saxons? Robbers?
Such a wound should have disabled him, at least. Most men would soon have died of it.
We're a tough pair. But enough. How did you happen to be abroad after dark, Svoboda Volodarovna?
You're clearly not the kind who ordinarily would. It was sheer luck that Rufus and I were in earshot. We'd been having a last cup with the Rus factor I've come to know. Bade him good night, since we must rise betimes tomorrow, set off, and then...
Ah, it seems God would not let a lady such as you come to sordid grief.
The wine glowed and thrilled in her blood. She remembered caution, but did find herself blurting out as much as Glape had revealed on her behalf to Olga Borisovna, and, as her voice ran on, to Igor Olegyev. Kadok's shrewd, quiet questions made it easy.
Ah, he murmured at length. Thank the saints, we did save you from ruin. That besotted mercenary would have left you in no state to hide what had befallen, if he left you alive at all.
He paused. Whereas you can tell your landlady, and afterward that man who's playing father to you, that you stayed too late at the church, lost in prayer. It's nothing unusual hereabouts.
She bridled.
Shall I give them a falsehood? I have my honor.
He grinned. Oh, come now, you're not fresh out of a cloister.
She didn't know what that might be, but caught his drift.
How often in your life has a lie been more than harmless, been a shield against hurt? Why put the good Glape in an awkward position when he has worked so hard on your behalf?
Impudently, as the go-between who brought Igor the Chandler a superb new wife, Glape can await excellent business deals. Spoil it not for him, Svoboda.
She covered her confusion by draining her cup. He refilled it.
I understand, he said. You are young, and the young are apt to be idealistic. Nevertheless, you have imagination and boldness beyond your years, more than most men do, that you would set forth into an altogether different life. Use that wisdom.
Sudden desolation welled up in her. She had learned how to turn it into mirth of a sort.
"You talk as my grandfather might have," she said. "How old are you?"
His tone bantered.
"Not yet worn out."
Eagerness to know surged like lust. She leaned forward, aware of his awareness of her bosom. The wine buzzed. Bees in a clover meadow.
"You've told nothing of yourself. What are you, a prince or boyar, ending his father's name not in Ev, but in Vich? The byblow of a forest god?"
"A merchant," he said. "I've followed this route for years, building my wealth till I own a ship. My stock is fine things, amber and furs from the north, cloths and delicacies from the south, costly without being too bulky or heavy."
Maybe the drink had touched him a bit also, for he added, puzzlingly, half under his breath, "It lets me meet people of many different kinds. I am curious about them."
"Where are you from?"
"Oh, I came through Novgorod, as traders from my parts do, by river, lake, portage, to here. Ahead lie the great Dnieper and its falls, hardest of the portages, that, and our military escort much needed in case of raiders off the steppe. Then the sea. and at last Constantinople. Not that I make the journey every year. It's long both ways, after all. Most cargoes are transshipped here at Kiev. I return to Swedish and Danish ports, or oft-times to England. However, as I said, I want to travel as much as I'm able. Have I answered you windily enough?
She shook her head.
No, I meant, what is your nation?
He spoke with more care.
Rufus and I. Cymru, the dwellers call that country. It is part of the same island as England, is the last of the ancient Britain. Best for me, because nobody there would mistake me for English. Rufus doesn't matter. He's my old retainer. He's gone by the nickname so long that he's well nigh forgotten any else. I, though. Cadog ap Rhys.
I've never heard of those lands.
No, he sighed. I didn't expect you had.
I've a feeling you've traveled more than you just said.
I have wandered quite widely, true.
I envy you, burst from her. Oh, I envy you.
He raised his brows.
What?
It's a hard life, often dangerous, always lonely.
But free, your own master. If I could fare like you.
Her eyes stung. She swallowed hard and tried to lay hold on the tears before they broke loose. Turned grave, he shook his head in his turn.
You do not know what becomes of camp followers, Svoboda Volodarovna.
I do. Understanding washed over her.
You are a lonely man, Cadog, she said around a thickness.
Why?
Make the best of that life you have, he counseled. Each in our own way, we are all of us trapped in ours.
You too.
Your strength must fade. Your pride shall crumble. In one more blink of time you will go down into the earth, and soon after that your very name will be forgotten. Dust on the wind.
He winced.
Yes, thus it seems.
I'll remember you, she cried.
What?
Nothing. I'm shaken and weary and I think a little drunk.
Do you wish to sleep till your clothes are ready?
I'll stay quiet.
Svoboda,
you weep.
Cadog came around the table, stooped over her, laid an arm across her shoulders.
Forgive me, I'm being weak and foolish. Not myself.
Please believe me, not myself.
No, certainly not, dear Ventura. I know how you feel.
His lips brushed her hair. Blindly she turned her head toward him, and knew he would kiss her. It was gentle. Her tears made it taste like the sea.
I am an honorable man of sorts, he said against her cheek.
How warm were his breath, his body.
I'd not force you to anything.
You need not, she heard through the great soft thunders.
I depart shortly after dawn, Svoboda, and your marriage awaits you.
She gripped him hard, nails into his coat.
3 husbands I have had already, she told him, and sometimes at the lakeside, the spring feast of Kupala.
Oh, yes, Cadog. For an instant she saw that she had let out too much. Now she must somehow answer his questions, with her head awhirl. But he gave her his hand. It was as if he lifted her to her feet and went by her side to a bed. Thereafter she was again in a dream. Her wanting him had come over her as a torrent. If she foresaw anything whatsoever, it was a slaking. He was not a big man, but he might be strong. He might take a while to finish, long enough, and then she could topple into sleep. Instead, he took the robe from her through a time that swayed on and on, and guided her to help him off with his garb, always his fingers and his mouth knowing what to do, what to evoke. And though the bed was narrow, when he brought her down upon it, he still stroked and touched and kissed, until she wailed for him to open the heavens and unloose the suns. Afterward they caressed, laughed, japed, spread 2 straw ticks on the floor that they might have real room to move about, played, loved. His head rested between her breasts. She urged him anew and yet anew. He swore he had never known the match to her, and the believing of him was a tall fire.
the glass in the window grayed. Candles had burned down to stubs. The smoke of them drifted bitter through a chill that she finally began to feel.
"I must see you to your lodging," he said in her arms.
"Oh, not at once," she begged.
"The fleet leaves soon, and you have your own world to meet. First you will need rest, Svoboda, dear."
"I am weary as if I'd plowed 10 fields, she murmured, a giggle. "But you did the plowing. You rascal, I'm hardly able to walk." She nuzzled the silky beard.
"Thank you, thank you.
I'll sleep soundly on the ship myself. Afterward I'll wake and remember you, and long for you, Svoboda. But that is the price, I suppose. If only... I told you, the trade I follow these days is a bad one for a woman. You come home from it after the season, don't you?" He sat up. His face seemed as gray as the light. "I have no home any more. I dare not. You couldn't understand. Come, we must hurry. But we needn't ruin this that we've had." Dumbly, she waited while he dressed and went to get her clothes from Rufus. The thought trickled through her. He's right. The thing is impossible, or at least it would be too brief and become too full of pain. He does not know, however, why he is right. Her garments were wet after washing. They hung clammily. Well, with luck, she could get to her room unnoticed. "I wish I could give you the silk robe," Cadog said. "If you can explain it away..." "No?" Maybe he would think of her when it passed to some girl somewhere else. "I also wish I could feed you. We're under time's whip, you and I. Come." Yes, she was hungry, faint with hunger and weariness and ache. That was good. It pulled her spirit back down to where she belonged. Fog hazed and hushed the streets. The sun had belike risen, but barely, in the east that Svoboda had forsaken. She walked hand in hand with Cadog. Among the Rusi, that simply meant friendship. Nobody outside would know when the clasp tightened. Few people were around thus far, anyhow. From a passer-by, Cadog learned the way to Olga's dwelling. They stopped before it. "Fare gladly, Svoboda," he said. "And you," was all she could answer. "I will remember you." His smile twisted. "More than is wise." "I will forever remember you, Cadog," she said. He took both her hands in his, bowed above them, straightened, let her go, turned, and walked off. Soon he was lost in the fog. "Forever," she said into the emptiness. A while she remained standing. The sky overhead was clear, brightening to blue. A falcon, early aloft, caught the light of the hidden sun on his wings. "Maybe it's best that this was what it was and nothing more," she thought. "A moment snatched free, for me to keep beyond the reach of the years. 3 husbands have I buried, and I think that was release, to pray them goodbye and see them shoveled under, for by then they had wasted and withered, and were no longer the men who proudly stood beside me at the weddings. And Rostislav had peered at me, wondered, accused, beaten me when he got drunk. No, burying my children, that was the worst. Not so much the small ones, they die and die, and you have no time to know them except as a brightness that goes by. Even my first grandchild, he was small. But Svetlana, now, she was a woman, a wife. It was my great-grandchild who killed her in the birthing. At least that was the final sorrow. The villagers, yes, my living children, they could no longer endure this thing that is I, that never grows decently old. They fear me, therefore they hate me. And I could no longer endure either. I might have welcomed the day when they came with axes and clubs to make an end of the thing. Gleip Ilyev, ugly, greedy little Gleip. He has the manhood to see past strangeness, see the woman who is neither child of the gods nor creature of Satan, but is the most lost and bewildered of any. I wish I could reward Gleip with better than silver. Well, I wish for much that cannot be.
Through him I have found how to stay alive. I will be the best wife to Igor Olegyev that I am able. But as the years pass, I will befriend somebody else like Gleb, and when the time comes he will find a new place, a new beginning for me. The widow of one man can marry again, in some town or on some farm well distant, and nobody she knew will think it is altogether outlandish, and nobody she comes to know will think of questions she dares not answer. Of course the children must be left provided for, such as are not grown. I will be the best mother that I am able. A smile winged by. Who can tell? A few husbands of mine may even be like Kadog. Her dress clung and dripped. She felt how cold she was, shivered, and walked slowly to the door of the house. Chapter 7. The Same Kind. 1. Habit dies hard, and then from time to time will rise from its grave.
"What do you really know about this drab, Lugo?" asked Rufus.
He spoke in Latin such as had not been heard for centuries, even among churchmen of the West. Nor had Kadog used that name for a span longer yet. He replied in Greek.
"Practice your living languages more. Get your terminology right. The word you used scarcely fits the most fashionable and expensive courtesan in Constantinople." "A whore be a whore," said Rufus stubbornly, though he did change to the modern tongue of the Empire. "You've been, investigating her, talking with people, sounding them out, damn near since we got here. Weeks, and me left to twiddle my thumb." He glanced down at the stump of his right wrist. "What are we going to do something?"
"Perhaps quite soon," Kadog answered. "Or perhaps not. It depends on what further I can learn about the lovely Athenaeus, if anything. And on much else, to be sure. I am not only overdue for a change of identity, we are both overdue for a change of occupation. The Rus trade is spinning faster and faster toward ruin."
Yeah, you said that plenty often. I've seen for myself.
But what about this woman? You haven't told me nothing about her."
"That is because patience and disappointment is not among your excellences."
Kadog paced to the single window and stared out. It stood open on summer air, odors of smoke and tar and dung and hinted fragrances, noise of wheels and hoofs and feet and voices. From this third-floor inn-room the view swept over roofs, streets, the city wall, the gate and harbor of the Contoscalion. Masts raked upward from the docks. Beyond glittered the Sea of Marmora. Craft danced on its blueness, everything from bumboats shaped like basins to a freighter under sail, and a naval dromond with oars and parade-ground step. It was hard to imagine, to feel, the shadow under which all this lay. Kadog clasped his hands behind his back. "However, I may as well inform you now," he said. "Today I have hopes that I'll reach the end of the trail, or find that it was a false scent. It's been maddeningly vague, as you'd expect. So-and-so tells me that somebody else once told him this and that. With difficulty, because he's moved, I tracked down curious somebody else to verify it, and to the best of his dim recollection, that is not quite what he told so-and-so, but from a third party he did once hear. Ah, well. Basically, Athenaeus is the latest name the lady has taken. No surprise there. Name changes are quite usual in her profession, and of course she prefers to obscure her origins, the fact that she was not always the darling of the city. I've established that earlier she worked as Zoe in one of the better brothels over in Galata, and I'm practically certain that before then she was on this side of the Golden Horn, in the Fanar quarter, as a less elegant girl calling herself Eudoxia. Beyond that, the information is slight and unreliable. Too many people have died or otherwise disappeared. The pattern has been the same, though. An outwardly affable but actually secretive woman who avoids pimps. At worst, formerly, she paid off as necessary, and spends no more on fancyments than she must. Instead, she saves, invests, I suspect, with an eye to moving up another rung on the ladder. Now she is independent, even powerful, what with her connections and the things she doubtless knows. And, despite the dull hound work that lay behind, despite the coolness he kept in his tone. A tingle went along Cadog's backbone, out to his scalp and fingertips. "The trail reaches at least 30 years into the past, Rufus. It may well be 50 or more years long. Always she is youthful. Always she is beautiful." "I knew what you was after," said the red beard, unwontedly low, "but I'd stop thinking you'd ever find it." "I too, almost. 7 centuries since I came on you, and nobody before and nobody afterward for all my searching. Yes, hope wears thin. Maybe today, at last." Cadog shook himself, turned about, and laughed. "I'm soon due at her place. I dare not tell you what a few hours there cost." "Have a care," Rufus grunted. "A whore be a whore. I go find me a cheap un, huh?" Impulsively, Cadog reached into his pouch and gave him a fistful of silver milliarisians. "Add this to your own coins and enjoy yourself, old fellow. A shame that the Hippodrome isn't open just now, but you must know several Odeons where the performances are bawdy enough for your less elevated moments. Just don't talk too loosely." "You taught me that, you did. Have fun. I hope she turns out to be what you want, master. I'll use a bit of the money to buy you a good luck spell." That seemed to be about as much as the prospect could move Rufus' stolidity. But then, Cadog thought, he lacks the wit to understand what it will mean to find another immortal, a woman. At least, immediately. It may dawn on him later. "I don't suppose I quite understand it yet myself." Rufus went out. Cadog took an embroidered mantle off its hanger and fitted it over the fine linen sakkos and bejeweled dalmatic that enrobed him. On his feet were curly-toed shoes from far Cordoba. Even for an afternoon appointment, one went to Athenaeus appropriately dressed. He had already gotten his hair cut short and his beard shaven off. Fluent in Greek and familiar, after much prowling, with the byways of the city, he could pass for Byzantine. Not that he would try to do so unnecessarily. It wasn't worth the risk. Rus merchants were supposed to stay in the St. Mamo suburb on the Galata side of the Horn, crossing the bridge to the Blakerni gate by day and returning at evening. He was still listed among them. It had taken a substantial bribe as well as persuasive chatter to get permission to take lodging here. He was not actually a Rus, he told the officials, and he was ready to retire from the trade. Both statements were true. He had gone on, mendaciously but persuasively, about certain new arrangements he had in mind, which would be to the profit of local magnates as well as himself. In the course of generations, given an innate talent for it, one learns how to convince. Thus he won freedom to pursue his inquiries with maximum efficiency. The streets throbbed and clamored with traffic. He followed their steepnesses to the Messe, the avenue that, branching, ran from end to end of the city. Down its width, on his right, he spied the column that upbore Justinian's equestrian statue in the Forum of Constantine, and beyond it, just glimpsed, the walls of the imperial palace grounds, Senate House, Law Courts, Hippodrome, the domes of Hagia Sophia, the gardens and shining buildings on the Acropolis, glories raised through lifetime after transient lifetime. He turned left. Brilliance flowed with him and glowed from the arcades that lined the thoroughfare. Plainness was nearly lost in it. Workmen, porters, carters, farmers in from the countryside, priests of the lower orders. Even hawkers and strolling entertainers flaunted fantastic colors as they shouted what wonders they offered. Even slaves wore the liveries of great households. A nobleman passed by in his palanquin, young dandies swooped in a wine shop, a troop of guardsmen tramped with mail agleam, a cavalry officer and his attendant cataphracts cantered haughtily behind a runner who shouted and elbowed people aside, banners flew, cloaks and scarfs billowed in a brisk wind off the sea. New Rome seemed immortally young. Religion yielding to commerce and diplomacy, foreigners were plentiful, be they suave Muslim Syrians, boorish Catholic Normans, or from lands farther and stranger yet. Cadog was content to vanish into the human flood. At the Forum of Theodosius, he crossed over to its northern corner
ignoring the sellers who cried their wares and the beggars who cried their need. Where the aqueduct of Valens overlooked the roof-decked Hollowitz band, he paused for a moment's breath. The view swept before him, down to rampart and battlements, the gate of the Drungarii, the golden horn full of its own fairings, and across those waters, hills, green with growth, white with the houses of Pera and Galata. Gulls yonder made a living snowstorm. You can tell a rich harbor by its gulls, thought Cadog. How much longer will this many fly and mew here? He thrust sadness from him and continued north, downhill, until he found the house he wanted. Outwardly, it was an unpretentious three-story building, hemmed in by its neighbors, the façade rosy-plastered. But that was ample for one woman, her servants, and the revelries over which she presided. A bronze knocker was made in the form of a scallop shell. Cadog's heart skipped a step. Had she recalled that this Western Christian emblem of a pilgrim once belonged to Ashtoreth? The fingers with which he rattled it were damp. The door opened, and he confronted a huge black man in Asian-like shirt and trousers, an entire male, likelier hireling than slave, well able to remove anyone whom his employer found objectionable.
"Christ be with you, Kyrie. May I ask what is your desire?"
"My name is Cadog Ap Rhys. The Lady Athenaeus awaits me." The visitor handed over a piece of parchment bearing the identification given him when he paid the price to her broker. That woman had had to decide first that he was suitably refined, and still she had told him no time was available for a week. Cadog slipped the doorman a golden bezant. A little extravagant, perhaps, but impressiveness might help his chances.
It certainly got him deference.
In a twittering cloud of pretty girls and two eunuchs, he passed through an anteroom richly furnished, its walls ornamented with discreetly erotic scenes, up a grand staircase to the outer chamber of a suite. This was hung in red velvet above a floral oriental carpet. Chairs flanked a table of inlaid ebony whereon stood a flagon of wine, figured glass goblets, plates of cakes, dates, oranges. Light fell dim through small windows, but candles burned in multiple holders. Sweetness wafted from a golden censer. A lark dwelt in a silver cage. Here Athenaeus was. She put aside the harp she had been strumming. "Welcome, Kyrie Cadog, from afar." Her voice was low, scarcely less musical than the strings had been, carefully trained. "Twice welcome, bearing news of marvels, like a fresh breeze." He bowed. "My lady is too gracious to a poor wanderer." Meanwhile, keenly as if she were an enemy, he assessed her. She sat on a couch, displaying herself against its white and gold back, in a gown that enhanced rather than revealed. Her jewelry was a bracelet, a pendant, and three rings, small but exquisite. It was her person, not her wealth, and her spirit more than her person, that she had the intelligence to emphasize. Her figure was superb in a voluptuous Eastern fashion, but he judged that suppleness and strength underlay it. Her face he would simply have called handsome, broad, straight-nosed, full-lipped, eyes hazel beneath arching brows, blue-black hair piled thick around the tawny complexion. It was not looks that had brought her to this house. It was knowledge, skill, perception, the harvest of how long an experience? Her laugh chimed. "No poor man enters here. Come, be seated. Take refreshment. Let us get to know each other." She never rushed to the bedroom, he had heard, unless a patron insisted, and such a one was seldom allowed back. Conversation and flirtation beforehand were part of a delight that was said to have a climax unrivaled. "Marvels have I seen," Cadog declared, "but the finest of them today." He let a servant remove his upper garment and sat down beside her. A girl knelt to fill their glasses. At a tiny gesture from Athenaeus, all attendants bowed out. She gave him a subtle flutter of lashes. "Certain men of Britannia are more polished than news of it led me to expect," she murmured.
Have you come directly from there? He observed the sharpness of the demure glance and knew she was taking his measure. If he wanted a woman who had more in her head than a mouth, that was what she would provide. Therefore, his pulse stammered. The self-control of centuries underlay the calm wherewith he regarded her, took a sip of the estimable wine, and smiled. "No," he said, "I have not been in Britannia, or England and Wales, as they call it nowadays, for a rather long time. But then, though I told your Aunt Scylla that is my country when she asked, I am not really a native of it, or anywhere else any longer. On my last visit here I heard rumors about you. They caused me to return as soon as possible." She half-shaped a reply, aborted it, and sat cat-watchful, too wise to exclaim, "Flatterer." He calculated his grin. "I dare say your callers number some with various peculiarities. You gratify them, or not, according to your inclination. It must have been a cruel struggle to win this independence. Well, then, will you indulge my whim? It is perfectly harmless. I only wish to talk for a short span. I would like to tell you a story. You may find it amusing. That is all. May I?" She failed to quite hide her tautness. "I have heard many stories, Kyrie. Do continue." He leaned back and let the words flow easily while he looked before him, observing her from the corner of an eye. "Call it the kind of yarn that sailors spin during calm watches or in taverns ashore. It concerns a mariner, though afterward he did numerous different things. He thought himself an ordinary man of his people. So did everybody else. But bit by bit, year by year, they noticed something very odd about him. He never fell sick, and he never grew old. His wife aged and finally died. His children turned gray and then white-haired. Their children begot and raised children, and likewise fell prey to time. But everything in this man since the third decade of his life stayed changeless. Was that not remarkable?" He had her, he saw, and exulted. Her gaze was utterly intent. "At first it seemed he might be blessed of the gods. Yet he showed no other special powers, nor did he do any special deeds. Though he made costly sacrifices, and later, approaching despair, consulted costly magicians, to him came no revelation, nor any solace, when those he loved went down into death. Meanwhile, the slow growth of awe among the people had, with equal slowness, become envy, then fear, then hatred. What had he done to be thus condemned, or what had he sold to be thus spared? What was he? Sorcerer, demon, walking corpse, what? He barely evaded attempts on his life. Finally, the authorities moved to investigate him, and he fled, for he suspected they would question him under torture and put him to death. He knew he could be wounded, although he recovered fast, and felt sure that the worst injuries would prove as fatal to him as to anybody else. Despite his loneliness, he kept a young man's desire for life, and the savoring of it. For hundreds and hundreds of years he was a rover on the face of the earth. Often he let his yearnings overcome him and settled down somewhere, married, raised a family, lived as mortals do. But always he must lose them, and after a single common lifetime, disappear. Between whiles, which was mostly, he plied trades where a man can come and go little remarked. His old seamanship was among these, and it took him widely across the world. Ever he sought for more like himself. Was he unique in the whole creation, or was his kind simply very rare? Those whom misfortune or malice did not destroy early on, they doubtless learned to stay hidden as he had learned. But if this be the case, how was he to find them, or they him? And if his was a hard and precarious lot, how much worse must it be for a woman? What could she do? Surely none but the strongest and cleverest survived. How might they? Does that conundrum interest my lady? He drank of his wine, for whatever tranquillity might lie within it. She stared beyond him. Silence lengthened. At last she drew breath, brought her look back to engage his, and said slowly, "That is a curious tale indeed, Kyrie Kadog."
"A tale only, of course. A fantasy for your amusement. I do not care to be locked up as a madman."
"I understand." A smile ghosted across her countenance. "Pray continue. Did this undying man ever come upon any others?"
"That remains to be told, my lady."
She nodded. "I see. But say more about him. He's still a shadow to me. Where was he born, and when?"
"Let us imagine it was in ancient Tyre. He was a boy when King Hiram made it King Solomon to build the temple in Jerusalem."
She gasped. "Oh, long ago."
"About 2,000 years, I believe. He lost count, and later, when he tried to consult the records, they were fragmentary and in disagreement. No matter."
"Did he meet the Savior?" she whispered.
He sighed and shook his head. "No, he was elsewhere at that time. He did see many gods come and go, and kings, nations, histories. Perforce he lived among them, under names of their kind, while they endured, and until they perished. Names he lost track of, like years. He was Hanno, and Ithabael, and Snefru, and Phaon, and Shlomo, and Rashid, and Gobor, and Flavius Lugo, and, oh, more than he can remember."
She sat straight, as if ready to spring, whether from him or at him. Low in her throat she asked, "Might Kadog be among those names?" He kept seated, leaned back, but eyes now full upon hers.
"It might," he answered, "even as a lady might have called herself Zoe, and before that Eudoxia, and before that names which are perhaps still discoverable."
A shudder passed through her.
"What do you want of me?"
He set his glass down most carefully, smiled, spread his hands, palms up, and told her in his softest voice, "Whatever you choose to give, it may be nothing. How can I compel you, supposing that were my desire, which it is not? If you dislike harmless lunatics, you need never see or hear from me again. What are you prepared to offer? Shared and lasting faith, help, counsel, protection, an end of loneliness. I've learned a good deal about surviving and managed to prosper most of the time, and have my refuges and my hoards against the evil days. At the moment I command modest wealth. More important, I stay true to my friends, and would rather be a woman's lover than her overlord. Who knows but what the children of two immortals will themselves prove deathless?" She studied him a while. "But you always hold something back, don't you? A Phoenician habit, which a rootless life has strengthened. I could unlearn it." "It was never my way," she breathed, and came to him. 2. They lounged against pillows at the headboard of the huge bed. Talk grew between them like a blossoming plant in spring. Now and then a hand stroked across flesh gone cool again, but those were gentle caresses. A languor possessed them, as if part of the lingering odors of incense and love. Their minds roused first. The words were calm, the tone tender. 400 years ago I was Aliat in Palmyra," she said, "and you in your ancient Phoenicia?"
"My birth name was Hanno," he answered. "I used it the oftenest afterward, till it died out of every language."
"What adventures you must have had!
And you,"
she winced,
"I would rather not speak of that. Are you ashamed?"
He laid a finger under her chin and brought her face around toward his.
"I would not be," he said gravely. "I am not. We have survived, you and I, by whatever means were necessary. That's now behind us. Let it drift into darkness with the wreckage of Babylon. We belong to our future.
You do not find me sinful?" He laughed a bit.
"I suspect that if we both grew quite candid about our pasts, you'd be the one shocked." Nor do you fear God's curse? I have learned much in 2,000 years, but nothing about any gods, except that they too arise, change, age, and die. Whatever there is beyond the universe, if anything, I doubt it concerns itself with us. Tears trembled on her lashes. You are strong. You are kind. She nestled close. Tell me of yourself. That would take a while. I'd grow thirsty. She reached for a bell on an end table and rang it. That we can do something about, she said with a flash of smile. You're right, however. We have the whole future wherein to explore our past. Tell me first of Cadog. I do need to understand him that we may lay our plans. Well, it began when old Rome departed from Britannia. No, wait, I forgot in all this joy. First I should tell you about Rufus. A maid-servant entered. She dipped her glance, otherwise seemed unperturbed by the two naked bodies. Athenaeus ordered the wine and refreshments brought in from the anteroom. While this was done, Cadog marshaled his thoughts. When they were alone, he described his companion. Poor Rufus, she sighed. How envious he will be. Oh, I expect not, Cadog replied. He's grown used to being my subordinate. In return, I do his thinking for him, give him adequate food, drink, and swithing, and he's content. Then he has been no balm for your aloneness, she said softly. Not much. But I owe my life to him several times over, and therefore this day's magnificence. Glib scoundrel. She kissed him. He buried his visage in her fragrant hair until she guided him to a glassful, a sweet cake, and sober discourse. The Western Britons preserved some vestige of civilization. Yes, I frequently thought of making my way here, where I knew the empire continued. But for a long time the likelihood of arriving with any money or arriving at all was slight. Meanwhile, life among the Britons was not too bad. I had come to know them. It was easy to move among identities and to stay reasonably well off. I could wait for the English, the Franks, the Northmen to acquire milder ways, for civilization to be reborn throughout Europe. After that, as I've mentioned, the Rus trade route let me make a good living and meet a variety of people, both along it and down here in the Mediterranean world. You understand that that seemed my only hope of finding anyone else like me. Surely you've cherished the same hope. Athenaeus, Aliat. He could barely hear. Until it grew too painful. He kissed her cheek, and she brought her lips to his, and presently she crooned, It has ended. You have found me. I keep striving to believe that this is real. It is, and we'll keep it so. With that practicality which bespoke her intelligence, she asked, What do you propose we do? Well, he said, it was about time anyhow for me to finish with Cadog. He's been in sight longer than he should have been. Some old acquaintances must be starting to wonder. Besides, since the Norman Duke made himself King of England, more and more young English, ill-content, have been coming south to join the Emperor's Varangian Guard. Those who happen to hear of Cadog would know how unlikely it is that a Welshman be a traitor of his sort. Worse, when the Rus lord Yaroslav died, his realm was divided among his sons, and they are now falling out with each other. The barbarian plainsmen take advantage. The routes grow dangerous. Fresh Rus attacks on Constantinople are quite conceivable, and could hurt the trade even more. I well remember what difficulties previous forays caused. So let Athenaeus and Cadog retire from their businesses, move away, and drop out of touch with everybody they knew. First, naturally, Aliat and Hanno will have liquidated their possessions. She frowned. You talk as if you meant to leave Constantinople. Must we? It is the queen of the world. It will not remain that, he told her grimly. She gave him a startled glance. Think, he said. The Normans have taken the last imperial outpost in Italy. The Saracens hold everything south of there, from Spain through Syria. They have not been totally hostile of late. However, the imperial defeat at Manzikert last year was more than a military disaster that led to an abrupt change of emperors. The Turks had already taken Armenia from you, remember? Now Anatolia lies open to them.
It will be touch and go whether the Empire can hold the Ionian littoral against them. Meanwhile, the Balkan provinces chafe, and the Normans venture east. Here at home, commerce shrinks, poverty and unrest grow, corruption at court vies for mastery with incompetence. Oh, I dare say the catastrophe will be a while in coming full upon New Rome. But let us get out well ahead of it. Where? Is any place safe and decent? Well, certain of the Muslim capitals are brilliant. Far eastward, I hear, an emperor reigns over a realm vast, peaceful, and glorious. But those are alien folk. The ways to them are long and beset. Western Europe would be easier, but it's still turbulent and backward. Also, since the church is openly split apart, life there has been hard for people from Orthodox countries. We'd have to make a show of conversion to Catholicism, and we'd best avoid conspicuousness like that. No, on the whole, I'd say we should stay within the Roman Empire for another century or two. In Greece, nobody knows us. Greece, hasn't it gone barbarian? Not quite. There's a heavy population of Slavs in the north and Vlachs in Thessaly, while the Normans are plaguing the Aegean Sea. But such cities as Thebes and Corinth remain well off, well defended. A beautiful country, full of memories. We can be happy there. Cadog raised his brows. "But haven't you given thought to this yourself?" he went on. "You could only have continued as you are for another 10 years at best. Then you'd have had to withdraw before men noticed that you don't grow old. And as much in the public eye as you've been, you could scarcely stay on in these parts." "True," Athenaeus smiled. "I meant to announce I'd had a change of heart, repented my wickedness, and would retire afar to a life of poverty, prayer, and good works. I've already made arrangements for the quick, quiet transport of my hoard, against any sudden need to escape. After all, that has been my life, to drop from one place and start afresh in another." He grimaced. "Always like this?" "Need forces me," she answered sadly. "I'm not fit by nature to be a nun, a she-hermit, any such unworldly being. I often call myself a well-to-do widow, but at last the money is spent unless some upheaval, war, sack, plague, whatever, brings ruin first. A woman cannot very well invest her money like a man. Whatever pulls me down, usually I must begin again among the lowliest and work and save and connive to become better off." He smiled as rueful. "Not unlike my life. A man has more choices." She paused. "I do study things beforehand." "I agree. On balance, Corinth will be best for us." End of side 4. Change side selector switch. This book is continued on the next cassette.